powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver.
It's the biggest musical competition in the country.
CITR is hosting our 33rd annual Shindig. It's a battle of the bands at Pat's Pub every Tuesday night.
We've curated 27 rad bands to compete for the title.
Who will take the crown from last year's winners late spring? Come to find out.
Fun fact, at this year's Shindig, there will be fun facts for beverages. Thanks to this year's sponsors, AMS Events, Backline Musician Services, Canadian Music Week, Discorder, Vader Master Studios, Rain City Recorders, Mint Records, Music Waste, Nimbus Recording, Thunderbird Radio Hell, Six Cent Press, Silver Fox Postering, Band Merch Canada, Blue Light Studios, Zulu Records, Fernie Brewing, and Print Print.
Come to Shindig this Tuesday, December 6th, to see Little Sprout, Dead End Drive-In, and Cheap Flavor.
Hello, and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Mark Coleman. He is a senior meditation teacher at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, an executive coach, and the founder of the Mindfulness Institute, which brings mindfulness trainings to organizations worldwide. And today we are talking about his brand new book, Make Peace with Your Mind, how mindfulness and compassion can free you from your inner critic. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Marie. Very nice to be here.
We normally start out with a bit of an intentional meditation. And since you are a pro in teaching meditation, I'd love to give you the opportunity to lead us in that today.
Of course. So, yes, so wherever you are, wherever you're listening, let's just take some moments to pause. So you might want to close your eyes and just turn your gaze of attention inwards to notice your body as you're sitting or lying or wherever you happen to be, standing, moving. And take some moments to feel and sense your breath. Taking some longer, deeper, slower breaths just to arrive here in the present moment. And be curious whatever else is here. Sounds, other sensations, feelings, thoughts. What's present in your direct experience? And can you meet that with a curious and welcoming attention? And as you're listening to this conversation in the next hour, to see if you can maintain a quality of attentiveness to yourself, to the words, to the thoughts and reflections or feelings that words might evoke, and as much as you can, being present fully to the experience of whatever unfolds, just as we do with life. So in your own time, you can open your eyes and we'll begin our conversation.
Now, I know that you are very busy with your book tour, and I can imagine that listeners can relate to that busy holidays going on, lots of work, lots of stuff on our mind. So I'm wondering how you manage through the day when things are more busy than usual.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely coming into a busy season with holidays and family and that kind of thing. And what I do is, I think it's really important for all of us to pause. So I take, you know, pauses in the day where I just close my laptop lid, or I, you know, turn off my phone, and I just take, you know, a few breaths. It may only be a minute long, or maybe a few minutes, or I'll go out on my deck and I'll sit and I'll just look at the view, or I'll go outside and stroll quietly for a few minutes, and just to interrupt that sort of habit of doing and busyness and rushing around. And so, you know, the breath, I find a really great refuge. I find being present in my body and noticing where I'm holding tension. I just relax my shoulders or my belly or my eyes. And then also just reminding myself, it's okay. It's all going to be okay. You know, we sometimes stress and rush around. Am I going to have enough food? And did I invite the right people? And what am I wearing? And where am I going to go? And just to reassure ourselves, you know, it's all workable. It's all okay. We're actually okay right now as it is. And so, but the pausing, stopping, taking some breaths, smelling the roses, as they say, I think it's really important when we get caught up in the details of rushing and doing and planning.
So I'm wondering if you could tell us kind of the story of how you discovered meditation. How did you become a meditation teacher?
Yeah, so it's a long story, and I talk a little about it in the book. I was in London. I was a punk rocker, anarchist. I was a very angry young man, and I was, you know, as we can when we're young, we can, you know, look to all the various things that we think are causing us problems or our pain or the pain of the world. And, you know, and I wasn't finding much satisfaction with what I was doing and, you know, being rageful at things. And so what I happenstance stumbled into a meditation center in the East End of London. And I walked in. I was searching for something, but I had no idea what I was searching for. I had no idea about meditation or Buddhism or anything like that. But I met these people who were working there, and they had a certain presence, a certain stillness and sparkle in their eyes. And this was in a pretty rundown part of London where I wasn't seeing that much that quality in people. And I just thought, these people seem to have figured out something that I would like to have a sense of or a taste of. So I started meditating, and I started doing mindfulness meditation, which is a simple awareness practice. And then I started also doing a loving kindness practice, which was bringing a friendly attitude to ourselves. And it was revolutionary. This idea of learning to turn your attention inwards rather than outwards, to actually understand yourself and your mind and your heart and who you are, was very revolutionary. And it really turned the course of my life. I dropped out of college and really began a lifelong study of meditation and mindfulness. And so went to Asia, studied with teachers in Asia, and then at some point came over to the States and moved to the Bay Area, where it's kind of a mecca for meditation and spiritual life and practices. And over the long course of training and study, I was invited to teach by my first teacher, and then did a training with Jack Kornfield, who's quite a well-known Buddhist teacher. And I've been teaching since probably the late 90s, so almost 20 years now.
So why should people meditate? Why is it important to you?
You know, I can speak for myself, and I can speak for the students that I work with. You know, what happens when people meditate is, I mean, there's a whole host of things. I think it helps develop a sense of self-awareness. I mean, there's a million kinds of meditation, so it's a bit of a hard question to answer because there's so many kinds, and each meditation has a different orientations. Meditations are more oriented to prayer, some towards developing concentration, some towards developing devotion, some towards developing psychic powers, but the meditation that I'm interested in are really how to become a more awake and free and kind human being. And so the practices I practice and study and teach are mindfulness meditation and loving kindness practice and compassion meditation. And why people should do that: when people are cultivating mindfulness, become more aware, they become more self-aware, they become more aware of their environment, of how they relate to others. They become less reactive, they become more generous, more kind, more thoughtful, more reflective, and more free, more happy, healthy human beings. And they also have the capacity to develop more kindness, more compassion, more love. So I see meditation as being the ground for any development as a human being to become a better, wiser, happier human being.
And I'm wondering what it would mean to you, Mark, if everyone became just a little bit more present.
I think we would be less reactive to each other. I think we would be more respectful. I think there'd be less, coming out of the horror of the 18 months of this election cycle, where there's a lot of judgment and creating a lot of otherness and animosity and all the negative things that span out of that. When there's more awareness, people are more respectful. There's more kindness. There's more thoughtfulness. There's less negativity and reactivity, and just a general, much healthier environment to be living in.
And I'm just curious what that would mean to you. Do you think would your quality of life be any different, or because of all of your meditation, are you just kind of able to deal with whatever come what may?
What would it mean to me? Who knows? I mean, it's a little hypothetical for me to fully wrap my head around if everybody meditated, which is something that's ever going to happen. But certainly mindfulness and meditation is becoming more popular because there's a lot of great neuroscience and research and data on the efficacy of it, and it's being taught in schools and businesses and healthcare, as I do all of those things. Of course, I much prefer being around people who are conscious and more present and more self-aware and reflective, and it's just a lot more interesting for me when people are unconscious. It's I don't find it that alluring to be around, frankly.
We're talking about make peace with your mind, how mindfulness and compassion can free you from your inner critic. And Mark, you wrote about how studies have shown that people tend to feel happier when they're in the present moment, as opposed to all the multitasking that is so common for our daily lives right now. And at the same time, you also talk about a study where people were given the opportunity to either sit in silence or shock themselves with an electronic shock. And most people chose to shock themselves rather than deal with the discomfort of just sitting there doing nothing. So I'm wondering, as you were writing that, how did that feel for you to consider that?
Yeah, well, I think it on one level, it wasn't surprising to me. We live in this culture now where everything's speeded up and we're addicted to our devices and screens and technology and the latest shiny object, whatever that is. So we've lost the art of stopping. We've lost the art of pausing. We've lost the art of being with ourselves, because if we're with ourselves for longer than a microsecond, then we, flip out our device and start surfing and Facebooking. And so it didn't surprise me that, it's hard for people to sit for 10 minutes on their own or would rather have some kind of stimulus, because we're so conditioned now to have stimulus. We get a little dopamine rush. We get a little buzz from the tedium of emails. We get a little ping each time that email comes in or the text comes in. And so I thought it was a sort of rather amusing but sad indictment of our times that we have become so conditioned to stimulus that we'd rather have pain than just be with ourselves. And there's a great line from I think I mentioned this in the book, French philosopher Pasteur, who said, most of the world's problems would be solved if people could learn to sit by themselves in a room for a few hours doing nothing. And this was back in the, I think, in the 16th century. So how true even more now is would that be really helpful to learn how to do that? And of course, in meditation, we learn how to be with ourselves a lot, to be with whatever's here, you know, whether it's beauty or love or impatience or boredom or restlessness or pain. And so it's a great training for life, because life is everything, right? It's both beautiful and joyful and difficult and annoying and challenging. And if we can learn to stay steady in the middle of it, which is partly what mindfulness does, it helps us stay present to whatever's happening, then we can find ease wherever we are. We don't need to have life be exactly the way that we demand it to be.
Speaking of that discomfort and sitting through meditation, I've been doing this course that's called the Process of Direct Awakening, and the commitment is to meditate for a minimum of 30 minutes a day. And what I've been noticing, I've actually kind of put it on the shelf for a bit. I really want to get back into the meditation practice. But what I was noticing is that through this process of direct awakening, the teacher is talking about really opening our focus and not focusing on anything in particular. And what I noticed is that it was so uncomfortable. Like, I can focus on my breath and that's okay, or I can focus on a sensation in my body, but just sitting there with this, with no focus, I noticed that I was so physically uncomfortable that at times it was almost painful and I had to stop. And I'm wondering, with all of the experience that you have in meditating and teaching meditation, if you have any insights for that kind of, how common is that?
To encounter a lot of pain when we're sitting with ourselves, that particular piece, or?
Yes. So for me, I do have some joint issues and some back issues. So I was laying back, even though that's not the ideal meditation pose, but it was just sensations like a little itch here or a little tension there. And I would try to let it go. And what would happen is it would get bigger and bigger to the point where at one point, the last time that I sat with this 30-minute meditation, I started crying because it was so physically uncomfortable. And that was the last time I did it. So I'm just wondering if you have any insight into that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, one of the myths of meditation is that, you know, everything gets better and better. You know, and we get happier and happier. And and not wanting to be a killjoy or anything, but, you know, well, at least from the training that in the practice that I'm familiar with, which is mindfulness and vipassana, which means insight. Basically, we learn to be present to our experience. And as I said, sometimes that's beautiful and calm and spacious and delightful and easeful. And other times, as you talked about, you know, we have physical pain, we have heartbreak, we have sadness, we have existential angst. And when we bring our attention to something, then what happens is usually that thing kind of grows. It becomes more prominent, right? And so if we have physical pain and we bring our awareness to it, not unlikely that it might magnify in our experience because we're giving it our full attention. And so you know, and that's both a training in how to be with experience. And of course, the point of meditation is to learn how to relate to experience wisely. And so, you know, in your case, I'd say, you know, when we're with physical pain or emotional pain, if it gets too much, it's completely appropriate at times to shift the attention, to focus on something else, to open your eyes, to feel your breath, to come back to something that's a little easier to be with, so we can actually stay balanced in the middle of whatever is happening. So that's really the point of mindfulness and any kind of awareness training, is to teach us how to find balance with whatever experience is present, good or bad. So I would say your experience is, you know, certainly not unusual. And often people will say, I don't like to meditate because I get too itchy, or it's too uncomfortable, or I think too much, or, you know, I have to feel my difficult feelings I spent, you know, the day running from. And I say, well, that is part of it. You know, it is a radical confronting of our humanness with all the joys and sorrows that entails. You know, so it's not for the faint of heart.
I'm curious, that is the biggest thing, was that itchy feeling. And I don't know why just sitting still would make a person feel so itchy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We have this phrase in the tradition, in the insight tradition that I'm in, that, well, it's not a phrase, but it's really just an understanding that sometimes the way the mind resists being present, it's almost like it can manufacture experience. And so for example, a common experience is we sit down to meditate, we're all feeling fine, and then suddenly, as you say, we're itchy, or we're really uncomfortable, or, you know, our skin starts burning or something. And then when we stop meditating, that completely disappears. And it's as if the mind is conjuring physical experience as a way to avoid simply being present. So it sounds like that was sort of happening for you. And, you know, the invitation is, can I be with that? Can I be present to it? Even if it feels like it's unbearable, because, you know, the truth is nobody's ever died from an itch. I actually find itches really fun places to work with, because, you know, they're uncomfortable or unpleasant, but they always have a sort of life cycle. They get really intense and it's like, oh my God, I've got to scratch that. If I don't scratch, I'm going to die. And if we don't scratch it, you know, it kind of eventually fades and we go, oh, that was interesting. That was just a blip in consciousness. So it's actually a really fun place to train if you can hang out with the discomfort. So that's my invitation to you.
All right. Well, I will give it a try. It sounds to me almost like the shocks, though. It's like, so it's fun to try if you can withstand the torture of being present to that itch.
Right. And if you can't, then it's fine to scratch it and then, you know, come back to whatever it is you're focusing on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that when I do scratch, it's just never the end. So I'll scratch an itch and then a fraction of a second later, I'll feel an itch on another part of my body. So once I start scratching, it's almost like there's no point in doing it, because as soon as I address it once, I may as well scratch the whole time.
Right. That is my point entirely, which is, once we give into those tendencies, then we're like a jumping bean. We're scratching, we're fidgeting, we're restless. So if you can learn to just notice the impulse and let it go, notice the impulse, let it go, the system will eventually quieten down, you know, become calmer. So that's, you know, that's why it's a training, you know, and you do as much as you can, and then you stay as present as you can and resisting the itch. And, you know, I use the phrase when we're meditating to orient towards stillness, which doesn't mean be like a stone, because we're not stone. We're sensitive, you know, flesh-bound bodies. So, but orient towards stillness. So, because the more still we become in our body, then it invites a more stillness in the mind. If we keep scratching and fidgeting and moving in every discomfort, our mind gets similarly agitated, and we don't, you know, it's hard to settle. You know, the whole thing becomes very frustrating.
Thank you, Mark. We are speaking right now with Mark Coleman. He is the author of Make Peace with Your Mind: How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. And you can find him at markcoleman.org. And Mark, as we were talking about sitting with that itch, it brought to mind more of a real life scenario for me, where a few years ago I was in this I was going through a really difficult breakup. And what I noticed is that if I gave in to the urge to call him, it was almost like that, like scratching that itch. I was starting off from square one again. But the longer I was able to withstand that discomfort, the less it pulled at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, basically we're looking at this foundational principle of neuroplasticity, which is, you know, what wires together wires together, in that if we practice something, we become that. If we do something a lot, that's what we, you know, it strengthens that habit. So if every discomfort, every itch we need to scratch, then there's no freedom when there's an itch. If, you know, whatever impulses, whether it's to ice cream or to alcohol or to whatever, you know, to judging, you know, in this case, you know, what I've written so much about in my book, if that becomes the norm, then that's what we become. And so we have to ask ourselves, what do I want to become? And I have freedom around that. And I have choicefulness around that. And what mindfulness does is gives choicefulness to see, you know, I don't have to be a judging person. I don't have to scratch every itch. I don't have to run from every discomfort. I can actually find some steadiness in the middle of it if I so choose.
And I think that's the key to what you're saying is freedom from your inner critic, freedom from whatever circumstances are going on, and to just handle it in the moment. You talk a lot about judgment and our inner critics. So can we talk about why we have an inner critic?
Well, that is a very good question. Why do we have these voices that we follow us around with judgment and shaming? My sense is that, you know, as children, you know, this self-critical pattern develops pretty young, and how it develops is, you know, as children, we need to learn, you know, as social creatures, we need to learn to fit in with our family and our culture and religion or whatever place we're in, a social group. We need to fit in so we can actually maintain a sense of safety and love and affection from caregivers. And so our system, our psyche, has to learn a way to kind of make us, you know, malleable enough to maintain that sense of, you know, goodwill from everybody. And the way that we do that, you know, as infants, we have a lot of strong feelings and impulses and reactions, you know, and we quickly learn how to tame those, because if we don't tame those, we get, you know, we get shouted at, we get judged, we get, you know, people might withdraw from us. And so the inner critic is a process in which we learn how to shut ourselves down, to, you know, to shame ourselves, to tell us that we're wrong, prior to somebody else like our parents doing that, because we don't want to lose their affection. We don't want to have their disapproval. And so we develop this internal mechanism, this voice, this pattern, which Freud way back in 100 years ago talked about as a superego. We now just understand it as this self-judging process that learns how to shame ourselves so we can actually shut those things down, and or those actions and reactions that will, you know, lead us to being rejected. And so, and that's all fine and good when we're young. You know, of course, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, we're still doing the same thing, even though, you know, we don't need to be worried about someone shutting us down or rejecting us, because we're an adult, we can take care of ourselves, but we still have those basic fears deep inside of us. And so, that critical mechanism that was useful when we were very young maintains itself. So we carry on judging or shaming or berating ourselves for doing something wrong or risking disapproval or risking rejection. And so the critic keeps rising each time we feel vulnerable or potentially at threat or potentially at risk of losing love or losing face or not being seen to be good or perfect or excelling at something. And so we berate ourselves in a way that's very negative and very unconstructive.
Mark, I'm curious, when you started with meditation, when you were that young man in London, the anarchist, angsty person, how long did it take you to break free from those judgments and from those reactive patterns?
You know, it took a long time, and it's a work in progress. You know, so you know, in the beginning, I, you know, when I turned that lens of mindfulness towards myself, I realized how much judgment and negativity I had towards myself. Like, I had a lot of self-hatred, and I was kind of shocked, actually, how hard I was on myself. And so through mindfulness, through becoming aware of the pattern, through seeing it, through, and then that was one piece of the process of cultivating that clarity. The second area was becoming aware of, you know, the opposite of the critic, which is to be kind, to be caring, to be loving, to be compassionate with oneself. And so I began this practice of loving kindness, which is basically a friendliness towards oneself that is a direct antidote to the critic, where we wish ourselves well, we wish ourselves happiness, we wish for the deepest things in our heart for ourselves. And so over time, that helps to mitigate the intensity of the critic. But it does take time, and it takes vigilance, it takes work, sometimes it takes love, sometimes it takes fierceness, sometimes it takes inquiry, sometimes it takes humor. And I talk about all these strategies in the book. There's a chapter called the Inner Critic Toolkit, where we need to have a variety of strategies to work with this very difficult voice in our heads.
Mark, what's your favorite strategy for dealing with that inner critic?
Well, my favorite strategy is the variety of humor that we can bring. So I think humor is most effective, because if we can laugh at something, it means we've got a little space from it. And if we can laugh at ourselves, it means we're not taking ourselves too seriously, that there's a little, you know, there's this space, this distance, and you know, we can see that, you know, we're all a little quirky and wacky and eccentric, and when we can see that, you know, we don't hold it so tightly. So, you know, for example, you know, I'm a mindfulness teacher, I'm a meditation teacher, and people might think, oh, well, in that case, you know, you must be all mindful all the time, and you must never lose things, you must never trip over or forget things. And, you know, and I'm a human being, and I lose my keys, and I forget where I put my phone, and, you know, sometimes I'm rushing out the door to go teach a meditation class, and I can't find my keys, and I'm going to be teaching on mindfulness, and I know the critic has its very predictable times where it will come and tell us, you know, that we're not good enough, that we're, you know, stupid, or, you know, bad, or never going to get life together, and I'll hear the critic start winding up, like, oh, there you are, you've lost your keys. Why didn't you put them in the same place that you could find them? And why are you leaving so late? And I just go, oh, hello, Mr. Critic, you know. And then I'll actually say, oh, Mr. Mindfulness wins the day again. As in, you know, yes, I'm a mindfulness teacher and I'm human. And guess what? I lose my keys on a not irregular basis. So I make light of it. You know, I used to imagine my critic with this gray wig, this, you know, like the London English judges wear, and just saying to myself, bad person, bad boy. And I would just sort of ham it up a little bit. Or when the critic's telling me about being Mr. Mindful, and, you know, not being mindful enough, I'll just say, oh, please, like, really, is that all you have to say? Or I might say, oh, thanks. I mean, I'm not very mindful. And what, and anything else? Oh, yeah. And you're a terrible person. Oh, yeah, thanks. And I didn't really know that. And what else? Oh, yeah. And you're also really suck at cooking. Oh, really? I didn't know that. And so I just invite it, rather than try and run away from it and be afraid of it and push it away. I just sort of go, you know, let's see what you've got to say. I'm not really that interested, but you can tell me anyway. And it's a bit like a Tai Chi move where we just, hello. No, thank you. And we let it sort of wash through us.
Thank you, Mark. You actually mention in your book just saying to critics, whether it's, I guess, your inner critic or people, you know, the peanut gallery has always got something to say. One of the things I notice is that it takes a lot in the moment of hearing unsolicited criticism. It takes a lot of willpower for me to just sit with it and not react. And you offered something that I actually wrote down for myself to remember for specifically for YouTube comments, actually, is thanks for your point of view or thanks for your opinion.
Right. Yeah, I think this is a really useful response because, you know, what's important to know about the critic is it is just a point of view, and it's also a very distorted, subjective, inaccurate perspective. I mean, it really is an opinion about us that we choose to listen to or not, and we choose to give authority to or not. And if we do listen to it and we do give it authority and we do believe it, we end up feeling pretty miserable because it's generally not saying very nice things about us. So if we can just you know, hear it and go, oh, that's interesting, thanks for your point of view, just like, you know, we might be sitting at a table or at a business meeting or in our family Thanksgiving dinner, and somebody might say, well, you know, that those clothes you're wearing look pretty scruffy. And you can say, well, thanks for your point of view. Thanks for your opinion. Like, you're welcome to, you're entitled to your point of view. I don't have to listen, or I don't have to take it on, or I don't have to care about it, but you're welcome to have your point of view. The same with the critic. It's, of course, it's welcome to have its point of view. It has points of view about everything because it's a judgmental mind. And again, if we can find that lightness of like, oh, that's interesting. That's your point of view. It's quite different from actually the how I see the truth of things. But I hear it and have a nice day. And then we just sort of get on with our day.
Thank you, Mark. I especially found that helpful as a strategy for dealing with other people, because I feel like if someone says something to me, then there's a response required. I mean, you don't just, if someone is like, oh, well, I didn't like blah, 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 if you just stand there with a blank face and no response, well, I guess that would be an interesting experiment to see what would happen. But I just feel like there's an urge to respond in some way, whether it's negative or whether it's neutral, like, thanks for sharing your opinion. So I feel like this is really helpful to me because it gives me a way to respond without reacting.
Right. Yeah. Because it's really important to have that sort of spaciousness in our minds where we can, you know, of course people are entitled to their points of view, including our inner critic. And we can just notice it, hear it. And then, you know, just like the wind lets the breeze blow through its canopy, we let the thought come and go, and we don't give it much attention, and then it's gone, you know, unless we pick it up and start perseverating on it.
So right now we are speaking with Mark Coleman. He is the author of Make Peace with Your Mind: How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. And I'm pretty sure it's safe to say we all have an inner critic. Mark, you have a whole section in your book about love, compassion, and vulnerability, and I'd love to take some time to talk about that.
Sure. What would you like to hear about?
When we talk about vulnerability, I feel like there is a big misunderstanding, because a lot of times people will put themselves in an unhealthy, vulnerable position.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think is the difference between the kind of vulnerability that opens up your world and the kind of vulnerability that creates more victimhood?
Yeah, that's interesting. So when I talk about vulnerability in the book, which I think is, vulnerability is definitely an essential part of being human. And as we grow and develop in our lives, and especially in our spiritual work and our inner work, it inevitably requires that we have an open to our vulnerability, because we are vulnerable as human beings to loss, to pain, to sickness, etc. And the more that we can be present to without reacting to or without judging the vulnerability, the more actually we can become stronger, we can become integrated, we can be with ourselves in a way that's empowering and connected. I think a lot of people run from their own vulnerability because it's hard to be with. Being vulnerable reminds us of when we were young, when we were vulnerable and it was scary. We didn't have resources. We didn't have, you know, capacity to deal. We didn't have the ability to say no or to leave. We were stuck with the situation that we were in. So, you know, it's why I talk about in the book that it's so essential to meet ourselves both with awareness, but also with compassion, because it's the compassion that allows us to meet that vulnerability. I mean, vulnerability is one of the hardest places to meet in ourselves because there's a sensitivity. There's, you know, we're almost hardwired as a species to not feel vulnerable because it's scary. It's what we feel under threat, and yet we can really grow and make tremendous transformations in that vulnerability, because it's really sort of one of the essences of who we are as human beings. It's those tender places, the raw places, the unresolved and unintegrated places that hold a lot of meaning and insight and understanding. But it does require that we are comfortable in that uncertainty and in that unfamiliar place.
Mark, I've been noticing more and more lately that we seem to live in this illusion that we're safe. We try to create a whole world and a whole narrative of our lives around being safe and secure, when really that's just an illusion that we set up so that we can get by in the world without being constantly worried. I'm wondering what you think of that.
So, can you say a little more about that?
Well, with our technology and our buildings and our Western health medicine, you know, we think that we can be safe from the world. And yet it's only when people come down with some kind of catastrophic diagnosis, like terminal cancer or something, where things seem to really change for them and they step out of that illusion that we can be in our little ivory tower and be safe.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, the truth is, you know, I mean, if we can all pay attention to our experience and to our lives and to, you know, our inner experience, you know, what I've appreciated about my Buddhist training and understanding is, you know, insecurity is the only security there is, in that, you know, nothing is really for sure. Nothing is guaranteed. We don't know from the next minute whether we'll be taking our last breath or experiencing an earthquake or hearing one of our, you know, loved ones is sick or dying. I mean, it's just, you know, it sounds dramatic, but it's really true. I have so many friends now who are, you know, diagnosed with, you know, cancer and chronic illnesses, and you know, they might go to the doctor for a checkup on sore throat and they find they've got no white blood cells, and they're at risk of, you know, having an infection, getting pneumonia and dying. It's like, we never know. And that is the nature of being human, is to be vulnerable like that. And so, you know, it requires we bring a kind, courageous presence to our experience and not run away, because of course running away doesn't help, because we can't run away from the uncertainty and the fragility of life. And and what I found with, you know, the work with the critic is that the critic, you know, has a great disdain for vulnerability and will shut us down, will judge us and be mean, because it's, you know, it triggers old memories of the challenge of vulnerability. That's why we need to create space in the critic so we can actually allow that tender vulnerability place.
I'm wondering, we are running out of time on today's show. We're speaking about Mark's book, Make Peace with Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. What do you feel is the most important point that you want to get across today about making peace with your mind?
Well, a few things. I mean, one is, you know, people often say to me, well, you know, I can't live without my judging mind because how would I make decisions? You know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a doctor, I need to be decisive and implement these things. I need to assess people. And I like to make the distinction between the judging mind that is negatively oriented, that is fixated or oriented around not just criticizing what we've done or said, but actually pointing to some basic inherent flaw that we're bad or wrong or stupid or deficient. So versus the kind of thinking where we can be discriminating, we can be discerning, we can be evaluating and assessing in very healthy ways, where we need that for our work and our life, and you need that to, you know, decide on, you know, whatever it is your work is, or you know, making plans. We need to be, you know, discerning about things. But the judging mind, we want to be very mindful of that voice. We want to notice when we're judging ourselves. It's really an attack on our basic goodness, our value, our worth. Because if we listen to that voice of the judge and we believe it and give it authority and take in its words over and over, which it, of course, is quite incessant, then we will eventually feel bad about ourselves. We will feel deficient. We will feel this, what I call the mantra of not enough. We'll feel maybe some hopelessness or some helplessness. And so it begins a cascade of feeling deficient and unworthy. And, you know, I think, you know, I was just talking to a San Francisco medical center around and my work, and I was saying, you know, I do think that the inner critic is a cause of a lot of mental health issues. It can lead to depression. It can lead to eating disorders. It can lead to suicidality if it's taken to its extreme, because it's basically, it's this ongoing monotone of that whatever we do isn't enough, isn't good enough, smart enough, quick enough. And if we really internalize that, we feel really bad in ourselves, which is very sad, because it's actually a very inaccurate understanding and perception. When I do my workshops on the critic, which I do lead workshops in various places, I'll have people write down their judgments, and then I'll have them read them, which is always a good thing to do, because when we read, we bring a little more discriminating awareness. And then I'll have them inquire into them. I'll ask, you know, is this really true that I'm stupid? Is it really true that I'm lovable? Is it really true that whatever I do is hopeless? Like, well, you know, if we really look at the data of our lives, we'll see that's not actually true. And then I actually have them, people share their judgments, because it's really important to realize, you know, we're not in this alone. As you said, pretty much everybody has a judging mind. And when we realize we all kind of have the same kind of mind that's down us for not doing this or being bad at that, or it takes some of the stigma, the shame out. So I think the more that we bring awareness to it, it's helpful. The more we bring kindness to the pain of it, it's helpful.
I'd like to bring it back to what you were saying about judgment versus discernment, because I find that this happens with me with compassion as well. There's sort of a difference between being compassionate with myself and just not caring. So I could, and I think that with discernment and judgment, it's very similar. So it's one thing to say, okay, well, if I eat a pint of ice cream before I go to bed, then the consequences are I don't feel healthy, it drags me down and make me gain weight, whatever. And that's really a lot different than saying, oh, I ate a pint of ice cream before bed, I'm a fat pig.
Right, right. Yeah, so the same data, two very different thoughts, and one makes you feel terrible and actually more likely to keep eating the ice cream because you feel terrible, so you eat more ice cream, you judge yourself for eating more ice cream, and it's just this endless cycle. Whereas if we say, you know, I get that you're feeling lonely and that's why you're heading to the Ben and Jerry's and we did this yesterday, it's not really going to resolve the problem. How about we put the Ben and Jerry's ice cream and we call a friend and we, you know, make some social plans, because actually what really is the issue here is loneliness. So we can, you know, we can bring a curious, befriending attitude to the critic and sort of basically inquire, what's really going on here? And is there a better way I can resolve this rather than acting out in the ways that I'm doing?
Thank you, Mark, because I feel like for myself, and I've heard a lot of other people say this, well, if I stop judging myself, then I'm just going to let myself go. I'm never going to work out. I'm going to eat ice cream all the time. And like right. you said, the more we beat ourselves up, the more likely we are to engage in that hopeless cycle of unhealthy behavior.
Yes, absolutely. Because it keeps reinforcing the sense that we're not good enough, and then we act out because we're not feeling good about ourselves. We compensate with these unhealthy strategies, and then we beat ourselves up for the very strategies that are trying to help us not feel so bad. And it becomes this very sad and painful cycle. And and that's why we have compassion, is because, you know, we didn't choose to be this. If we could find a better way, we would. And so you know, so it's important that we're forgiving of ourselves, and we also take more constructive action to find a more healthy way to move forward.
We're speaking with Mark Coleman, the author of Make Peace with Your Mind: How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. And just before we wrap up, I'm wondering if there's a phrase or a short process that you can take us through that would help with being more compassionate with ourselves.
So for those who are listening, as you're listening, let's just take a moment to pause. I mean, you might want to close your eyes. We'll do a little reflection. Just to try a couple of these ideas or points of view on, see if you can connect. First, imagine yourself as a young baby. You've just come into the world. You're 1 or 2 days old. You're vulnerable. You're impressionable. See if you can sense into the part of you as that young infant that has basic goodness. There's no hatred or fear or animosity in that moment. There's, you know, in our essence, we have essential goodness, not, as some would say, original sin. And feel into that vulnerability, feel into that need for love and affection. And then fast forward to present time and feel that same vulnerability within you, that same goodness, that same need to be loved, to be seen, to be held, to be cared for. And contrast that with the way that you might be critical and judgmental and harsh to yourself. Feel into that difference. And ask yourself, is there a kinder way to be with yourself? Maybe you just take one of the things that your critic might be judgmental towards you about. Maybe the way you look, maybe the way you work, maybe the way you play sports, or the way you meditate. And you can thank it for its point of view. And you can ask yourself, you know, what's really going on here? Why am I being so harsh with myself? Say, for example, maybe I'm being critical of my meditation or my spiritual practice or my yoga or my body, not good enough. Not enough. And then ask yourself, what is a different way to be with this experience? What's in the root of the judgment? What's there? Is it fear? Is it wanting to be liked? Is it, you know, caring deeply about your spiritual practice that you want to grow? So see if you can orient towards what's possible rather than what's wrong. You thank the critic for its point of view, and you make some intention, some aspiration. Oh, I'm going to really commit to my practice. Yeah, I don't do it every day. I don't do it as long as I would like to. And I really care about it. And I'm going to make a positive intention to practice. practice, to take care of my body, or whatever the situation is. And then lastly, closing with loving kindness, which is to express a care and a wish for ourselves. So I'll say a few phrases and express this heart of friendliness. May I be safe and protected. Say these phrases to yourself. May I be happy and peaceful. May I live with ease. May I love and accept myself just as I am. And so throughout the day and the evening, see if you can carry these phrases with you. And then you can open your eyes and just notice how you feel, bringing a sense of warmth rather than judgment.
Thank you so much, Mark. That was beautiful. And before we wrap up, I'd just like to ask if there's anything that you feel is important that we haven't had a chance to mention or ask you about today.
So many things. I can't underestimate the importance of, you know, bringing that clarity of awareness to our thoughts, and to name the judgments, to see them, to notice how much you might believe them, notice how much you might listen to them, and then keep letting go. Keep noticing them and letting go. You don't need to absorb them. Don't need to let them land. And then to keep bringing a sense of kindness and care to ourselves. That's really important.
Thank you so much, Mark. Well, we have been speaking with Mark Coleman. He is the author of Make Peace with Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. And you can find him at markcoleman.org if you'd like to get in touch. And thank you so much for listening today. Thank you to Mark for his valuable time. And I appreciate everyone who's taken the time to connect with us. And I just want to send you lots of love today, and just a reminder that we're all doing our best in each moment, and wherever we are in this practice is where we are, and that's okay. So thanks again for your time. I want to send you lots of love. Be well.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities.
They are doing this by developing gender-affirming, client-centered models of service.
Ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available.
And supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support.
Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for the trans members of our community.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursdays 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Tune in every Tuesday from 8 till 9 p.m. for Inside Out with your hosts AJK and Zia for exciting new dance music.
It's the biggest musical competition in the country.
CITR is hosting our 33rd annual Shindig. It's a battle of the bands at Pat's Pub every Tuesday night.
We've curated 27 rad bands to compete for the title.